in a land dominated by desert. Some things are easy to find.
Sand?
Check.
Sunlight?
Check.
Tumbleweed?
Check.
But in New Mexico, you might find something else you wouldn't expect.
Farmers.
Agriculture. Food. Life. And just about everywhere. But how?
My name's David.
And I'm Milani.
We're students at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology.
We are part of a group that spent the past year researching solutions to some of the biggest problems in food security. And we went to New Mexico to get a better understanding of one of them, desert agriculture.
It might sound like an oxymoron, but looking at the crops in New Mexico, it's clear that life finds a way.
These sweet peas are what we call rebeldes, rebels. So they planted themselves. Whenever we get a random guy that pops up, we call them rebeldes because they just wanted to go for it, and they went for it.
It's impressive enough that crops managed to grow in the dry climate.
Sure, we marveled at the carrots and the onions, but behind the scenes, how each farmer adapted to the challenges of a desert landscape was what really stood out. So we drove across the state to explore a variety of places where farmers, for one reason or another, chose to plant their roots.
From the highlands to the vast plains, from fields of alfalfa to little plots of radishes and carrots.
We wanted to talk to the people who worked this land.
And after hearing about their struggles and their tough decisions,
about their inventive ways of farming,
and most of all, about how much they care about their way of life and the work they do,
there was something we realized.
The farmers in New Mexico?
They're rebeldes too.
What we try to produce here is not necessarily a head of lettuce or a tomato. Because of the ancient properties of this land, because of the usage that it's been in for thousands of years, the work that we do here is sacred. When we plant something, we're not necessarily producing a head of lettuce because we're consuming this living, breathing creature. Living energy becomes our own consciousness. So what we raise here on this farm is not necessarily lettuce or tomatoes or chili, but consciousness.
That was Lorenzo Candelaria, the owner of Cornelio Candelaria Organics, a farm near Albuquerque.
So we just watered and we had a leak today, so just be careful, it's a little wet. Just be prepared for mud. Can you guys identify any of these crops?
And this is Travis McKenzie, his employee, introducing us to the farm.
Travis leads us through the densely packed rows of lettuce, kale, and arugula, picking leaves and eating them off the plant as he talks. Looking just ahead, the crowded, rambling green of the farm fills our view.
Looking just a little farther, orderly rows of suburban houses come into view. In some ways, this farm is just a plot of land surrounded by a subdivision.
Travis and Lorenzo view the land as much more than that, though.
Too, so we are totally organic, so if you want to pick a leaf and try it, please feel free.
This farm has been in my family for a little over 300 years, and the care and nurturing that it has taken over a period of 300 years is very intimate. So this has become truly my mother.
This is all just live food. It's just veggies. Like Lorenzo was saying, it's pure life. So really what we're doing is we're harnessing the energy of the sun, the potency of the seed, the sacredness of the water, and the nutrition and the sustenance in the soil to create life. It's beautiful.
Here, nestled between suburban backyards and the growing sprawl of New Mexico's largest city, their farm is advocating for an unconventional approach.
We're all about keeping ancient practices and blending them with modern technology and techniques, but having a nice balance and always respecting Mother Earth in those endeavors.
They have built a system based upon respect and recognition of the land, treating it as a living, breathing person.
Mother Earth will continue on. We all gotta remember, by taking care of Mother Earth, we are taking care of ourselves and our future generations.
Life in the New Mexico desert can seem like a competition against the land. Travis and Lorenzo's philosophy, working with the land instead of fighting it, stands out as different. It's why they let the rebeldes grow, instead of pulling them out.
And this farm, in the middle of suburbia, provides a place for their philosophy to be shared.
I've seen people that come in here very anxious and very stressed, and spend a couple of hours pulling weeds, and by the time they leave, they're happy people again. It's a beautiful way to connect.
Travis and Lorenzo have worked hard to make sure that a deep, personal connection to the land is not lost.
They keep this connection in an urban area. We visited another group of people who maintain a similar philosophy, far from the big cities.
My name is Desiree Deschini. I am of the Tengil people clan. I was also born for the Tengil people clan. And my maternal grandfather, he's of the Water Coming Together clan. And my paternal grandfather is of the Nicaraguan people.
Desiree is a member of the Navajo tribe who grew up in the northwestern New Mexico city of Farmington.
The Navajo built their society over the course of centuries. The Navajo Nation currently spans a vast tract of land that occupies parts of New Mexico, Arizona, and Utah.
And the Navajo have used this land to their advantage. Farming is deeply ingrained in their society. In fact, their nation contains one of the largest irrigated farms in North America.
In Farmington, the sandy brown of the desert land is broken up by expansive circles of green. This is the network of commercial irrigated fields.
But moving farther into Navajo land, the industrial fields disappear altogether. Instead, you may run into a small field and a mother and father outside tending to it. This is a family farming on a small scale, growing native crops as they have for generations.
Traditionally, the Navajo are known for growing corn, beans, and squash. These crops are often called the Three Sisters, and the people use them to sustain both themselves and their cultural practices.
Much of Navajo philosophy and life actually revolves around farming. There's just a lot of sacred foods that you grow, and then you utilize those for your nutrition, for your physical health, but also for your spiritual health. Corn's a big deal among the Navajo because we eat it, but we also pray with it. And so to grow your own corn is just a very mindful way of trying to provide for yourself.
This corn culture extends to daily routines. For example, at the school where Desiree runs a community garden, the students and teachers use corn in a morning ritual every day before classes start. This corn ritual is common among Navajo people, as she explains.
The holy people, Dien Dine, they are most listening during the dawn. And during that time, you usually say a prayer. Sometimes you'll have like either corn pollen or even corn grindings to just kind of offer as a blessing.
She also told us about another, even more personal, ceremony.
It's called Kenalda. It's when a girl becomes a woman. And during that time, you spend 4 days preparing to bake. One of the big things is that a way to demonstrate as a woman your ability to cook, to provide, is to make this cake made out of corn. Before you're making this cake, you're grinding the corn physically with rocks.
The continuation of Navajo culture relies on access to corn. So what happens when the corn that they use for ceremonial purposes is threatened?
In the summer of 2015, a chemical mine spill released toxic wastewater into the river that feeds much of Navajo land. They responded by closing irrigation ditches to protect their fields. But the loss of water devastated production and posed a serious health threat.
We spoke to a Navajo Farm Board official, Joe Ben Jr., to get some insight on how the spill has affected the community and the agriculture that supports it.
So if you're in a culture that consumes corn for ceremonial purposes and for domestic purpose, table use, and if you have only 10% of your normal yield, and you're gonna still need to pray and you still need to do your ceremonies, you're gonna use that 10% for that. So what should have normally gone on your table will be gone, missing.
And yet, when it came to the survival of Navajo culture, he was optimistic.
The Navajo people come from a culture that has never been severed. A culture that's never been severed since the introduction of Western culture. For that reason, you have to have hope. If it has gone this far without being broken, you hang your hope and your faith on that past history of endurance and resiliency.
There's something we've been leaving out of this whole equation so far. Remember, we're in New Mexico. And getting food requires more than just putting a seed in the ground. You need a secret ingredient. One very specific chemical that's a little hard to come by in a desert.
It's called dihydrogen monoxide. Water.
Tucked away in the northern New Mexico highlands is a town called Chimayo, where agriculture means a lot more than just producing food.
And where water is handled a little differently.
The red-streaked hills nearby are covered with brush. Along their sun-beaten tops, small wooden crosses stand watch.
Further off in the distance lie snow-capped mountains whose spring melt will fill this valley with life.
Down here, a collection of fields, well-trodden dirt paths, and a cluster of pastel-colored houses. This is El Rincon Farm.
And that's the sound of a ditch being cleaned.
To all appearances, it looks just like any old ditch.
But this is an acequia, part of a centuries-old tradition of irrigation and community governance in New Mexico.
On the surface, an acequia is just a network of irrigation ditches. But what makes them special is the way that communities band together to maintain them and share the water.
For instance, here's how the acequias are cleaned.
A group of 20 to 30 members of the acequia, or parciantes, line up in the ditch, 10 paces apart, and clear all of the debris out of their section.
And as a person finishes his portion of the 10 feet, he stops. And then when everyone stops, you know, they're ready to move. And to move, the way we do it is yell out,
Vuelta!
Meaning shift.
That's Teodoro Trujillo, or Ted, a farmer from Chimayo.
As an acequia farmer himself, Ted is an expert on the philosophy and practice of the acequia tradition.
Everyone lines up at the beginning of the acequia. The acequia, of course, is the irrigation ditch, but it's really a bigger word than that. It's almost a form of government. It's a form of land-based philosophy and practices. And actually, the whole business with water is sharing. You know, what else can you do with it? If someone else needed water, you'd accommodate them. You know, it's just sort of basic common sense that we're here to help each other. So it works out fairly well, and it's probably the most important thing we've done because we're trying to conserve water on the assumption that there'll be less of it over time. El agua no se vende, el agua se defiende. Water isn't to be sold, water is to be defended.
Ted is also an attorney who specializes in water rights law.
His daughter Pilar is a project specialist for the New Mexico Acequia Association, an organization that works to protect the acequias, honor their cultural traditions, and feed their communities.
To learn more, we went right to the source of water for Chimayo's acequias, the Santa Cruz Dam.
There, Pilar told us all about one particular success in the fight to preserve the acequias. A law passed in 2003 that gives the acequias more control over the water that flows through their ditches.
A mechanism in the law was put in place to protect acequias from water transfers happening outside of the community. And so it's a really crazy concept that there's wet water and then there's paper water. And the paper water, that's what we call the paper water, is the water right. And then what you can do is you can take that piece of paper and sell it to somebody else. It can be a hard concept for some of our people to grasp because water can't be separated from the land, you know, that's not how it works.
But that's just it. What sets the acequias apart is that in other parts of the Southwest, water can be separated from the land.
With the acequias, the community owns the water. They decide how to divide it up so that everyone gets their fair share.
And they almost lost that.
And it creates a drive for people who have traditionally been very cash poor and all of a sudden find out that they can sell some water for some money, but you're not actually removing the water. It's still there. So it's hard to be like, oh, that's not a good thing to do. It's hard to get the concept of like, you will never be able to use that water again on your land ever. Before, all you had to do was show up at the state engineer office with an application saying, I want to transfer my water. I want to sell it. And then that was a loss to the community. And if four or five people on an acequia do that, that could just threaten the whole acequia, you know, because there's not enough people farming, the land dries up, and it's a sad situation. We lose a lot of things.
Five people may not seem significant, but with every Parciante that leaves, some of the independence that fuels the acequias leaves too.
And even if it's only a few people that leave, that's a lot of water that the acequia can no longer use to support agriculture in the community. It's just gone.
Now, the only thing we did was say, listen, acequias have always been autonomous. They've always been sovereign. They've always governed themselves. Let us decide whether or not that water should be transferred out of the acequia. So now that's it. That's the simplicity of the law. If you're not from here and you don't have a real understanding of the acequias, then you can have a hard time understanding why are we going to protect this, like, ditch, you know?
It's really a joy to see the water in it. It's like having a waterway next to your house, you know, in a desert. Can't beat that.
At this point, New Mexico might seem like a patchwork of small, self-sustaining farms.
The reality of farming today is that not all food comes from the Travises and Teds of the world.
So what's the other side of the story?
We visited some farms that were a little different from the ones that we've seen before, like Lac Farms in the southern part of the state. Just driving through the fields takes a while.
Driving on dusty dirt roads, our path cuts through sharply defined fields. Row after row of trees and plants are ordered with eye-catching geometric precision.
You could find yourself getting lost in the seemingly unending expanse of, well, food.
We passed by pecan orchards, cattle corrals, vegetable fields, and processing plants.
At a stop to the side of an alfalfa field, we spoke to Clayton Kreese and Jake Welmsma of Lac Farms about what farming means to them.
I'd say farming's really about feeding the world, you know, just trying to grow the most possible on the least amount of land in the shortest amount of time.
The truth is, by 2050, we will have 2 billion more mouths to feed.
2 billion. And being right there, surrounded by a sea of green in the middle of a desert, it's not hard to see why Clayton and Jake have an appreciation for scale.
But isn't something lost in this kind of production? It's hard to picture Trevise or Pilar being on this farm.
It's a hard question to answer. Larger farms like Lac, using more conventional, industrial methods, do produce a lot of food.
And that food ends up feeding a lot of people.
To the guys at Lac, modern technology is what makes all of this possible.
We use lots of different herbicides. Not lots, but, you know, everything has its own herbicide. You know, we have a herbicide that we spray on the grasses, and we have a herbicide we spray on broadleaves. But you got to keep your plant healthy, and insecticides, herbicides, and fertilizers are part of that.
For them, pesticides are just a tool to produce a quality product.
When it comes to making decisions about what goes on their plants, the farmers at Lac speak from their own experiences.
I actually worked for an organic farm in the area before I worked here. I noticed a huge difference in the quality. The farm that I worked for was mostly a hay farm, alfalfa, and the bales of hay that we sent out were 50% weeds. We really weren't getting a quality product at that farm that we do here. And I think that's the main difference, is the quality.
As they tell it, no matter how large their farm is, it comes down to whatever results in the best product for their consumers.
You know, I eat it all, and let me tell you, I think it tastes better.
All the farmers we talked to shared a pride in their work. They believe that they're producing good food.
Another conventional farmer is Dave Lowry. His pecan farm is a well-groomed expanse of trees and concrete irrigation ditches, nestled in a valley near Las Cruces in southern New Mexico.
My background, like I said, I was born and raised here. I've been a farm and ranching my whole life through cattle and production agriculture. What we do is the harvester is back here in the back, the big blue unit on the right-hand side is a self-propelled
Dave harvester. Knows how to run this place and how each piece of equipment fits in. His process is optimized for efficiency, and he's worked most of his life on farms.
Goes through, sorts out the trash, nuts go in the back into a cart. That cart will go back, raise up.
And like Clayton and Jake, Dave's a big fan of his own product.
There is nobody in the world that raises a finer, better tasting pecan than this valley right here, bar none. But if I lay pecans from Georgia on a plate, pecans from here, and pecans from Oklahoma on a plate, I guarantee you, you'll pick the ones from here.
But change always comes, and well, farms need to survive. They struggle with finding the balance between passion, people, and profits.
For 20 years, Dave was general manager at another, even larger, pecan farm, where he had to make some tough decisions.
We had 112 permanent employees on 4,000 acres of farm, okay? We had specialized irrigators, specialized backhoe operators, specialized tractor drivers, specialized this. No. I want one man that can run that backhoe, can run that tractor, can run that, can irrigate if I need him to. So from 112 permanent employees, I cut it back to 46. And I'm human like the rest of you. I mean, I love people, I really do. I love employees, good employees. But when it comes down to the pocketbook, a lot of that stops. Because you have to survive. It wasn't for the board of directors or the owners of that farm. It was for your all's family. We're doing this. This is our farm. This is our philosophy. This is our farm. We take care of it. The more we can do and the better we are at doing it, the more we can share.
Those layoffs were possible because advanced machinery can take the place of some workers.
For Dave and the farmers at LAC, adapting to new technology doesn't diminish the value of farming. It's their way to create the best product they can and share it. This is what survival means to them.
Survival of agriculture in the desert. It seems so unlikely.
As we've heard, the harsh conditions in New Mexico mean that farmers need to make tough decisions.
And those decisions are guided by their values.
When they're faced with challenges, from little things like letting the rebel peas grow, to major decisions like laying off employees,
they have to give up a lot. They have to decide what really matters.
In the end, what's left is their farms.
The physical manifestation of their values.
The purest expression of who they are.
And there's beauty in that.
In how farms have their own unique, living identity that is shaped by people's lives.
So, when you look at what really defines the farms of New Mexico,
it's the people, the faces behind the food.
This piece was produced by Terrascope Radio at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Terrascope is a freshman learning community focused on complex environmental issues. It is part of MIT's Office of Experiential Learning. Terrascope Radio was developed in collaboration with MIT's Department of Comparative Media Studies. A huge thanks goes out to everyone we interviewed throughout our trek across New Mexico. To Professor David McGee for enthusiastically leading the Terrascope program in fall class. To Emily Martin, for keeping us well-organized and well-fed on our trip to New Mexico. To Jake Berga, our undergraduate teaching fellow, for his audio expertise. And finally, to our amazing instructor, Ari Epstein, for providing his guidance, insight, and encouragement as we went through the process of creating our piece.
I'm Laura.
I'm Brandon.
I'm Daly.
I'm Milani.
I'm David.
I'm Lily.
I'm Quint.
I'm Mandy.
And I'm Kip. We are Terrascope Radio 2016, and we hope you have enjoyed the broadcast.